Calling all small firm architects. It's time to tap into your full potential with Entree Architects Context and Clarity, where inspiration meets innovation. Hey, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my two favorite co-hosts, Jeff Eccles and Katie Kangas, as they bring together authors, experts, and thought leaders for electric conversations with entrepreneur architects around the globe. It's not just a podcast. It's a community where dreams meet action.
There's a simple equation there. And what for me, what that did, just doing that basic calculation, was it allowed me to compare what I had actually saved in my retirement accounts to what I thought a possible projected annual spend might be.
Artists are temperamental, so beautiful design is going to be a priority. When the job is done, we're going to actually need to live in the house, not live with the person who designed it. And so for me, the artistic skill, the architectural skill is most important. And so I would say like that would be 60% of it, if not more.
Gain insights to build a successful practice. Subscribe, engage, and let's redefine your future together. Join the Context and Clarity community, where every conversation adds to your blueprint for success. My name is Mark R. LePage, and you are listening to Entree Architect Podcast, where each week I speak with inspiring, passionate people who share their knowledge and expertise, all to help you build a better business as a small firm entrepreneur architect. Joyce Owens, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today. I know so much about you guys, so it's quite an honor to be sitting here on the other side and speaking instead of just listening.
I'm excited that you're here. You have a great story and you're doing great work, and I want to share that with the audience. Let me introduce you to anybody who may not know who you are. Joyce Owens is the principal architect at Architecture Joyce Owens, also known as Studio AJO. Joyce is the recipient of the 2022 Gold Medal of Honor awarded by the American Institute of Architects Florida chapter, recognizing her leadership and significant contributions to the architecture profession, her communities, and architecture at large. In 2020, she was awarded the organization's Medal of Honor for Design, AIA's Florida's Pinnacle Design Award, honoring her as one of the most influential architects in the state. Joyce is based in Southwest Florida, essentially ground zero for Hurricane Ian, a Category 4 hurricane that devastated the region's ecosystem, the economic system, and the built environment just this past September in 2022. Hurricane Ian, I looked it up, is the third costliest weather disaster on record and the deadliest hurricane to strike Florida since 1935. So it was a big one. I actually have family in the area as well. I was down there this past winter after the hurricane, and I've never seen anything like it. It is devastating is not even the right word. As designers, as leaders, as problem solvers, architects play a vital role during these natural disasters. And I want to know, you know, through this conversation, I want to talk to you, Joyce, about how we can leverage our expertise as architects during these critical times, these periods of crisis, not only to help stabilize and rebuild the region, but also to demonstrate the value that we have as architects for all the world to see, to sort of step up and say, here we are, this is what we do, this is how we do it. And this is a great, perfect stage to not only help the region recover, but also demonstrate what architects do. And so I'm really looking forward to having this conversation with you, Joyce.
Thank you.
Great. Let me ask you, before we jump into talking about all the things that you're doing and how you're doing them, and how you're recovering from the hurricane, because you are based right there. I want to know more about you as an architect. I'd love for you to share your origin story, going back to whenever you feel like going back to, and when and how did you discover architecture as a profession, or maybe who or what inspired you to get started?
Oh, okay, great. Yeah, I don't think I had a traditional route into architecture, in that I thought when I was very young, I loved my animals. And so I thought I was going to be a veterinarian. And that's what I had always just focused on that. So I did my math and I did my science and I did well in school and I went to pre-veterinary school and I got there, I got to college, and it took me about 2 or 3 weeks to realize that was not what I wanted to do after all.
What was it about the early part of the education that made you realize that after all those years, my daughter wants to be a veterinarian. So it's a little selfish question, but that shifted your thoughts?
I think it was, I had always had pets and I loved to ride horses and my whole world had really been about animals. But when I got to school, when I got to college, I went into the laboratory where they would do a lot of the work.
Yeah.
And there were big, long stainless steel tables with big, long rubber gloves. And
yeah, not cute little
realization
kittens.
Hit me that, this is not just about loving these animals. This is the true nitty gritty. And I had done things like, mucked out stables. And I mean, I was used to all of the dirty bits of animals too, but I just thought, no, that's not how I want to spend my life though. And so, so I stayed, I was a bit lost for about a year or two. I didn't know what to do because
I could imagine
good at math. And so I kind of went down the math route. Oh, I'm going to be an accountant or I'm going to be maybe an economist. I thought maybe that's where I was headed. And then I went to a Catholic high school and I wasn't allowed as a female student to take a drafting class. Right. I was completely discouraged. No young little girl had done this, right? And so I was, like all other little girls, discouraged from doing the drafting class with the boys. And so I thought, well, while I'm taking all these classes, I'm going to take a drawing class. I'm going to see what that was in my head one day. I wanted to do that. And I'd asked the little nun, I can't remember what her name was, sister something, why can't I take that class? And so it was like 3-4 years later, and I took my first drafting class. It wasn't a design course. It was literally a drafting class. And I thought, this is good. This is very good. This
you
is
found,
a skill I
found
good
your
at.
Home.
Yeah. And so I was like top of the class and I was like, I really like this. I can listen to music. The weather's nice. I have the windows open. Like it was just a great experience.
Were you creative as a child?
I was. And I think that was the problem. I had forgotten as a child. I was very artistic and very, because my parents said I was one of three. I was one of five children, but I was the only girl. Mm-hmm. And so my parents were very clear that they didn't care what my brothers did. They didn't expect them to go to college. They let them do what they wanted to do. But with me, I was always told I had to go to college and I had to be a licensed professional. I had to be a doctor or a lawyer I never heard of an architect, so I didn't know at the time. And so they always pushed me. So I was being pushed to be a doctor. And I thought, okay, that's fine. Yeah. That'll work. I'd like to be a veterinarian doctor.
Right. And so, right.
And so, so that worked out really well for me. Go ahead.
When was it that you discovered architecture? The architecture as a profession? So you took that drafting class. At that point, did you know that there was a profession of architecture that you could pursue and that was sort of a trial?
I did know one architect who was a nice, handsome, tall gentleman that fit the bill of an architect. Okay. Very charming man. He was a friend of the family. And he just seemed so unattainable to me, right? Mm-hmm. Like he was an architect. I didn't know what he did, but I knew that person existed. And so that profession existed, but I didn't really know what they did. And so I went and I asked him, I talked to him then. And so the timing was good because he lived in Florida and we were coming to Florida. And so I had the chance to talk to him and he encouraged me. He always encouraged me then after that. He kind of watched me go through school. When I went to England to work for a few years, many years, he was always there for me to, listen to my stories about what I was doing while I was in London working. And so he was great. He became a great mentor as well.
Yeah. How important was that relationship as a mentor for where you are today?
Huge, huge. Yeah. And I don't think he even knew any female architects, And so, but he just took me like, so seriously, he just was so encouraging and so You know, I don't think it was a day-to-day kind of mentorship. Yeah. I had a boss that was an excellent mentor who did give me the day-to-day that I needed. So two men were my mentors. I didn't have any like female role models at the time, but I did have these two men that were very good at helping me to, you know, understand what I was supposed to be doing. And my boss that I worked with, he was great. He loved working with women. He knew there was a value in being a female architect. So they had hired about four of us at the same time and really encouraged us to go take our exams. And we were actually the ones that were passing our exams, where at the time, I don't know, maybe they didn't encourage the guys as much as they did us, but we all got licensed then. So that was great. Yeah, very important relationships.
Yeah, mentors are so important. And as architects, you know, start their own firms and become more influential in the profession, so many of us just get busy and we forget that sort of reaching back to the younger generation is an important part of making sure that the profession thrives as we grow.
I love our interns, and I have to say, as my practice grows, I don't have as much time to be one-on-one with them the way I used to. When the business was smaller, and our interns would come in for the summer, and I would give them a lot of tutoring one-to-one. And I can tell you, it's paid off for those people that, you know, didn't get that attention from me, because they were young, they were still in school, and I was, you know, really explaining to them, you know, the process of what we're doing. And, you know, the goal of being an intern at my office is, no matter what level you are, I always try to get you to do a permit set of something, whatever it is, before you leave, for, you know, after 2 or 3 months, that you're I try to get you to understand that process of very quickly. You know, it's like doing a little charrette, right?
Yeah.
It's a design. You do the design, you get to work with the client, you get to, you know, draw it up, you get to work with the public officials to understand the codes and so on. And then, cause I always figure, you know, once you understand, that's your goal, is to like get the design and the permits. Like, it's just bigger. It just happens the same way, right? It's just bigger and bigger and more
just
complicated.
Just scale it up. Time. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's kind of always one of the things that I try to get our intern to do.
So how did you find your way to Florida?
My family had always come here in the winter, because we lived outside Chicago. We lived just over the border in Indiana, and they hated the cold. So we would come down for 2 or 3 weeks every Christmas, and they ended up buying a condominium, and then they ended up retiring young to Southwest Florida. So that's how I found my way here. I don't know if it was the first time I came here to live was to get my license. So that I knew was the right thing to do. That was a good time to be here, and I was with my family. You know, the second time I came back was after I'd been in England for 15 years. And so I came back again to be with my family, because at that point I had a young son. And so I returned to my parents so he could, you know his grandparents better.
Yeah.
And career-wise, that was not my best decision, because I was very, it was a bit of a cultural desert down here, architecturally. It was a very difficult place for me to think, after having a practice in London, which was very successful, to think I could come back to small town, you know, Southwest Florida, and just be who I was there.
Right.
And so if I would have been clever about my decision, or not used, you know, paid attention to my personal situation, I would have gone straight to New York and just carried on. But I made a decision. And it was funny, because it was much harder to work in Southwest Florida than it was in London. London was much easier to be successful, I found.
How did you end up in London?
I had a scholarship at one point. I got a scholarship. So I took it after I graduated from my degree. And so I just went to do some postgraduate work. And because I got the scholarship, I don't know, somebody suggested I should do it. And so I did it. And it was a Rotary scholarship, and I won the Rotary scholarship. And, it was a year to do whatever you wanted, like whatever you wanted, anywhere you wanted in the world. I know. And so, I was hoping to go back to Italy. But they encouraged me not to go to Italy, because I'd already lived in Italy for a year. So they wanted me to go somewhere else. And at that point, it was too late. I only knew English. I knew enough Italian that I knew I could learn it quickly, but I couldn't study in any other language. So I just ended up going to London, which was great. It turned out great because I ended up staying and starting a business. And yeah, it was great.
And you were there for 15 years, you said?
15 years, yeah. And 10 of those years, I had my own business. So imagine, I was that young. I was like, gosh, I guess I was 33. I started my own business in another country.
Yeah.
That was kind of crazy.
And 10 years, I mean, that's a fully established firm and successful and doing work. What? Yeah. So family brought you back? Was it that?
Yeah, it was family that brought me back.
Could come back to your parents and let your kids
have
a relationship with grandma and grandpa.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, the time in London was great. And within 10 years, we were, this was the most surprising thing, I suppose, because I was in partnership with another woman and she was Turkish. So we were two foreigners, female foreign architects in London. And after sort of 9 years, let's say, I guess 8 or 9 years, we were actually noted by Architecture Review as one of the top 13 emerging architectural practices in the UK.
Wow.
So that happened very quickly for us. And then, but we had an amazing clientele with people like Alexander McQueen, the fashion designer. We did 2-3 projects for him. And we did an exhibition for Vivian Westwood. We got involved with the fashion world, and like they're very creative people. And so it was just an amazing like ride to be involved with them. So it was good. Oh, Boris Johnson, Prime Minister. We did his house. That was fun.
Wow. So that must have been a very difficult decision to make.
Oh, it was. Oh, yeah. You still, you know, to this day, I wonder. I'm sure it was the right thing to do. Okay. But yeah, but you still, you always wonder.
You have a very successful firm today, and, you know, and hopefully your children have a good relationship or had a good relationship with your parents. And so that's a very important part of life. And so, you know, things happen the way they happen, right?
They do. Exactly. It wasn't easy at the beginning. It's not that I loved being back in Florida, because I do love it here, right?
Yeah.
And so I would never complain about being here, because I do love it here. But from a career standpoint, it did take a long time to get going. So I have to say, things like getting, you know, the medal that you mentioned, you know, the gold medal from AIA Florida.
Yeah.
That all happened very quickly too, because I wasn't even here for all those years, right? So for me to get it as quickly as I did, I think was
What year did you move back to Florida?
2004.
So that region has developed quite a bit in the last 20 years.
Oh yeah. I mean, since I was a kid, I mean, it's just a different place.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. I did similar vacationing in that area. My grandparents would do the similar thing that your parents did, where they would go down for a few weeks to Fort Myers. Actually, they would spend their time in Sanibel on the island.
Nice.
And then when they retired, they bought a house in Fort Myers and moved to Fort Myers. And so as children, we would go down with my parents to go visit my grandma and grandpa, my nana and papa, actually. And and we would go visit. And so that's a very special place for me as well, that whole area, Fort Myers, Sanibel, Captiva. And now my parents actually spend their winters in Cape Coral. And so I know that region very well. And I remember it as a child. and so I know how much it's changed in the last 20 years. And it's changed significantly. So anybody who visits that area now would be like, well, there's culture and there's architecture and there's everything that you would want in, as an architect. But 20 years ago, it was a lot of farmland and, you know, it wasn't what it is today for sure. So I can imagine how difficult it was to start.
It was. And at the time there was this big push to be doing Mediterranean architecture, right?
Yeah.
So everything was Mediterranean. I'm like, what is this Mediterranean stuff? They don't even build this in the Mediterranean. Like, what are you talking about? I was like, this is Mediterranean. In the Mediterranean, they build beautiful, like modern buildings now. I mean, it was horrifying. I called it the beige phase, right? Everything was beige. It was like, whoa. That was tricky. And so one of the things I did, because I was so frustrated with the situation I was in, was I don't know why this happens, but I often meet journalists and become friends with them. And so I had become friends with people that worked for the local newspaper. And I asked them if they would write some stories about architecture, because I couldn't deal with the beige. And I was like, why don't we educate the public by doing this? And so they did try on a couple occasions. Some journalists would come and they would talk to me, and they didn't understand what I was trying to say. They had so many questions. Like, they were like, oh, I'm so interested in architecture. And then they had so many questions because they didn't really understand like essence of what we do. And I would try to say things about, well, we shouldn't really be designing this Mediterranean look because it's really for a dry climate, not for a wet, humid climate, because we have torrential rains here and high humidity. And Mediterranean, you know, if there is such a thing as Mediterranean architecture, or Spanish, I guess, revival, if only it was Spanish revival, because that's much nicer. That's for a dry climate, though, right? That is not meant for, you know, being in a wet climate. And so, it kind of worked. It frustrated a lot of people, the journalists. And so in the end, I asked a friend of mine about writing an article for the local paper. And she loved the idea. And so it took about 6 months to convince the paper that a professional could actually write about their profession to the public, because their problem is they tried it in the past. And they said that oftentimes a professional, any profession, okay, will write in their own architect, whatever, in their own professional speak, right?
Right.
And so, communicate to the public. And so they said they would try it out. And so I did it for about 4 years, I guess. I had a monthly column. It was a sweet name. She gave me the name, called Architect About Town, which I thought was a very clever title. And I really, I liked being Architect About Town. It was fun. And so I had a following and it was good. And so that was a really nice platform for me to be trying to talk about architecture. And really what I was saying, like, it took me many months to get there, but what I wanted to say was, like, let's go back to the early history of Florida architecture. And let's see what the early inhabitants did in this very harsh climate, and how did they live before? And so we month by month, I sort of took us through the different building types. And then my goal was always to get to mid-century architecture, because I find a lot of merit in mid-century for this climate, because the mid-century architects, the good ones of the time, really understood that we were in this wet and hot climate. And so they really designed their buildings to accommodate that climate, as well as look back at some of the early, like, I went back as far as the Indians, right? And the Cheeky Hut and so on. And to a lot of the principles of good mid-century architecture are based on those principles. And so I was trying to, like, bring up an evolution, like, okay, now we did mid-century and then it went off the rails, right? With this Mediterranean beige. And then, like, let's pull it back and let's find a new kind of vocabulary that we can use today, because we have better technology than they had in the mid-century to create buildings that are really appropriate for here. And they don't have to all be modern flat roofed. I mean, you know, a lot of times a hip roof in our climate is like the best roof you can get, because not only is it great for getting the rain off, but it's also fabulous for redirecting wind around it without pulling it off in a hurricane, right? So there are many kind of nuances to design in this climate that I was trying to talk about.
And yeah. So
it was great. I got to talk about my mentor when he passed away. I actually got 2 months in a row, I got to write about him and do a nice kind of two-column obituary on his behalf. Loads of people knew him and loved him. I got a huge response for that. And it was good. It was fun. It was a fun time.
And you've really dedicated much of your career from that point forward to educating the public about what architects do and the value of architecture in our world. You've volunteered at AIA National, right?
All the way up through my local chapter, through the state, where I got to be president of the state, and then on to national. And Until last year, I was on the public outreach committee, which was absolutely my favorite committee to be on.
Yeah. So it all started with those articles that you saw the benefit of those articles of sharing your knowledge with the general public at their level so they can understand what we do. And I love that story because I think all architects should be doing that, not necessarily writing articles, but sharing their story in their own way, sharing their expertise so our general public can understand what we do and see the value in what architects bring to the world.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think it actually started one step before that. And it was a time when I was with my business partner in England, I told you, another woman, and we had finished our first project and we had it professionally photographed. And she called me on the phone and said, the proofs are back. And she said, it's unbelievable. She's like, we're real architects. Like, we look like the real deal. These are beautiful photographs. And we really, this is something, you know, you got to come over here. And so I came to see her to see the proofs. And she says, oh my God, we're going to get published in Architects, Journal and the RIBA Journal. And I said, why would we do that? And she's like, well, because these are beautiful. And I said, we don't want to go there. We want to be in Vogue. And she's like, Vogue? Why would we be in Vogue? I go, oh, interesting women with talent that created something beautiful.
Right.
And so, she just looked at me and smiled. And she was just like, absolutely. That's what we want to do. You know, and to me, it was almost like I wanted people to see what architects did. And I also needed to probably get the next job because that was our first job. So we needed more work too, and we weren't going to get it being published to the architects.
Okay? Yeah. I mean, it's nice to have your work published for other architects to admire and see and the glory that all comes with that, but it doesn't do a whole lot for your business. Yeah. It doesn't do a whole lot for our world other than, you know, sharing our architecture with other architects. And so,
right. Which there is value in that, but I would definitely put my energy on the public instead, because that's where the work is going to come from and the appreciation of what we do. And the more like to the public, that's, you know, another opportunity for them to the public to read that and to hire another architect. So, you know what I mean? It's not just for me that I'm doing it. It's for all architects.
Right.
Because I feel it's so important. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's exactly what I want to share is that as much as we're doing and as much as it's difficult to run our own businesses and be an architect, it benefits us all if we take on some role of sharing the work that we do and the importance of what we do and our expertise. Let's take a quick break to say thank you to our sponsors for their support of this episode. Accurate data is crucial, especially in today's business environment. Outdated and inaccurate data leads to turnarounds, delays, and rising costs. With supply chain and staffing issues, these costs and delays can multiply. That's why a resource like RCAT.com is so important. RCAT works with manufacturers to keep their data up to date and accurate and offers it to you easily, accessible, and free. Use RCAT's powerful search engine to find what you need fast and download it right there on their site without needing to pay for anything. It's free. So go try RCAT.com today. That's ARCAT.com. Please visit our sponsors today and thank them. Thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. And you've recently, you know, you've done all of this and gone through national and has been on the committee at national level. But with the hurricane, you and I have talked offline before, that has also given you some opportunities to sort of share your knowledge and leverage your expertise in designing sustainable and resilient architecture in that region that you can see in that region. All you have to do is tour one of those areas that were hit by the hurricane, and you can see the homes that were resilient and they were built to modern standards and the homes that weren't.
Right.
And the sustainability also with the way modern architecture is designed versus the way architecture was designed in the past, especially through those Mediterranean periods. You know, with the EFIS and all of the terrible stucco that was done in the wet climates.
You can imagine that not only rotted, molded, fell off, but if it was still hanging after these years, it was all blown off, you know,
right,
the wind. So, that's exactly right. What's happened is through the articles that I was writing about designing for this place, okay, and this region, I was also educating myself more and more all the time about what's better and talking to people and getting experts in to explain about various things. And so I was getting better and better at it as well. And so there is a momentum once you become an expert in whatever it is you're an expert in. And so journalists did find me and would ask me, you know, to do work with them on a piece, an article. And so they would call me and ask me. And most of the time, interestingly, I would always talk about energy efficiency and how if we design appropriately for here, we have to use our air conditioners less because it's really hot here, right? And so what we don't want to do is waste all our energy for no reason when if you design just simple, passive, design ideas, you can just save so much in energy. And so I would talk to journalists about that and so on. And so, and interestingly, my practice has really started, I call myself a coastal architect now because while we do a lot of work in town, most of our work is really on the island. And where it's become best known is really on coastal properties. So right on the Gulf of Mexico. So there's an expertise not only in building and understanding the materials and the quality of the materials that have to be used in salt air, but also the permitting, which is extensive once you're building on the coast, because not only are you raising up higher, but you have to build stronger. And so that, you know, you don't want your buildings to get blown away, nor do you want the floodwaters to knock the buildings over. And yeah. So it seems more in the past couple of years, while I was learning about all of these things and I was building according to what I was learning, I wasn't even talking about the resiliency part of it. I was talking more about the sustainability and the climate part when I wasn't focusing on the resiliency. And so, I don't know, maybe a couple year and a half ago or so, I just started realizing like the resiliency component of what we were doing. And I gave a couple talks about things like that to the local public about the resiliency. I even have a great slideshow when I'm talking about hurricanes and how we should build, you know, these buildings stronger. And then sure enough, when the hurricane came and all of the buildings that my firm had designed were still standing where the rest of the island is, you know, devastated. And, you know, it's like, well, why are these buildings still standing? And so that got a lot more attention because we were doing that. So it was great. We started to we immediately started an Instagram kind of blog about resiliency and talking about that. And so, sorry, we have a little friend that came to visit me right now.
So we have a cat on the screen.
We have a cat here. She's very sweet.
What's her name?
Her name is Sophia.
Hello, Sophia.
Yeah, she's a love bug. Yeah. And so so we started doing the Instagram account and talking about this resiliency. And that just snowballed into, journalists that had spoken to me in the past were calling and just, even if they weren't writing a story, they were just using us as sort of a reference.
Yeah.
You know, like these architects know what they're doing and they know better than other people in the community, what's just happened? Why did this stand? Why did this get knocked down? And so, as well as a lot of that going on in the background, we've also, you know, recently got invited to be, I was really surprised, to be the keynote speaker at a building science seminar, which normally focuses on mold and like mechanical systems and lots of aspects of dealing with the climate down here and how our buildings, you know, they either have to breathe or they can't breathe, right? And like what works and what doesn't work, you know, what do we foam our attics? All these various kind of important things about learning to build down here, which is making our buildings better and better down here,
Yeah.
But I actually got to talk about this resiliency side of things, where we're designing the buildings, you know, from below ground all the way up to the roofs so that they withstand the hurricanes. And so that was quite an honor for me as the architect to be up there, because it's not, there's only a few architects in the audience typically, and but to be in front of all these experts, you know, that are known around the country for their expertise and to be able to talk about it. So,
yeah. That's a perfect example of leveraging your expertise, right?
Yeah.
And through the work that you're doing, sharing your knowledge at a public level, not to other professionals, you make a difference. You start educating the public. You start educating journalists. Then they start knocking on your door saying, hey, we want to know what you know. Maybe you can come speak to our organization. Now you're speaking to the builders who are now also interested in what you're doing. Which then results in business, right? People start knocking on your door because now you're an expertise.
That's the hope. Okay. That's the hope. Yes. No, it does turn into that. And it's been, you know, after the storm, we definitely have the reputation as the coastal architects, which I started saying, you know, like I said, like a year and a half ago, because I'm like, oh, this resiliency thing is a big deal. We're going to call ourselves coastal architects now, so that they come to us to do those buildings on the beaches, right? So that, like, if we're known as the coastal architects, they'll come to us. I think that, I was going to say something else, though, about, we're talking, in my instance, that is my expertise now, right? That's what I'm known for. I want to hope, too, we're also known for doing, you know, nice buildings as well.
Good-looking
buildings, right? So
great design.
As well, because I don't want clients, you know, to think that's what I'm all about. Like, it's super superficial, right? It's not just a pretty building. It's actually, you know, a building that's stronger and smarter. And so, because it actually does work in our climate. I think one of the things I learned in the last few years working with the AIA is talking to so many different architects from around the country. To have that opportunity is that this is my expertise, but there are so many things that architects do in their communities, which is mind-blowing to me, how influential they are and how they are so willing to give their time and their energy to make their communities better. And this was best known when Mark Levine and I, who was one of the board members, did a talk together at the AIA National Grassroots last year. And it was about communicating the value of the architect. And it was quite incredible to be able to hear the stories that people were telling us about what they had just done and, you know, and how they had made a contribution. And then it was like, the question was, well, who else learned about that? Oh, it was just the mayor and I talking, you know?
Right.
And or it was just this focus group that I belong to and how we brought this thing out of the ground. And, you know, we were able to help with some master plan that we volunteered our time for. And it's like, and you didn't tell anyone that you did this, you know, and they're like, well, we don't know who to tell. And it's like, or they're so busy doing the work that they forget to tell people that that's what they're doing. And I think the stories just were endless. And I think that was the biggest frustration of that talk, not by us, but by the people that were attending it, was that they felt that the general public didn't find the value in architecture or in an architect, despite the fact that they would be out there helping them and, you know, making their contribution. Then at that point, then they would say, oh, you can help us with that? We didn't know that was something an architect did. And so I think that's a very valuable lesson that I learned, is that once I received the gold medal, that was kind of my resolution after that, was like, okay, I've received the gold medal, but what do I do with it? And so that became one of my goals, is to actually really focus. Although I had always focused on that, it was to even put more effort into that idea of, you know, asking architects, you know, to go out and to spread the word and to tell their stories. Just, it doesn't matter who you tell, but just don't be afraid to tell it, right? Don't forget to I was in front of it was the design awards for AIA Florida. And so I was in a big room. It's a gala. It's a nice big event. And then I'm the last one to receive the award because it's the gold medal. And so that's what I did. And, you know, I said thank you to everyone. And then I said, okay, now it's your turn. You know, like here, this is you're the best of the best in Florida, right? Take this home with you. Like you're whatever you've just received this award for. And I don't mean to like, it's not just I've won an award, but why did you win that award?
Right.
You know, what is
share your expertise.
Award?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I, that was the beginning of, you know, like me really deciding that I'm really going to make this like my next goal. And so,
That's your mission now.
That's my mission. Well, it's always been my mission, but now it's like, now this is really my mission.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So,
and then the hurricane came and then it really, really gave me yet another platform, which I didn't even think to talk about, right? Yeah. But like all architects, there's just so much more, you know, than a pretty building. So
yeah, and I think you know, I think the pretty building is the expected part. I think the general public does already expect us to design well. Yeah. It's the rest of the stuff that they don't know we do, right? It's and that's the story we need to tell. Is what do we do every day? Right? What are our expertise what's our contribution to the world beyond the well-designed buildings?
Yes, exactly. And you know, like the buildings I design, like they're more than pretty buildings, right? And so, I think that's it's a really important lesson that no one tells you about along the way. You know, when you go to school or whatever. And why I ever thought of that moment when I said, no, we want to be in Vogue, right? Vogue. I don't care about those architects. I don't care what those architects think. And I wish more architects would think that way, you know, would be less interested in getting the glory, you know, from their peers and more interested in telling their story. I think we'd all benefit more if we each told our story.
And truthfully, it's more fun to get the glory from the public.
It is very rewarding. Yes. It's very rewarding because it's very humbling as well to be recognized for something you're good at.
Yeah. Well, thank you for doing what you do and for sharing your story. I'd love to ask my final question that I ask all my guests. So we get your take on this. What would you say is one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Well, I think it's very much related to what I'm talking about. I think that a small business really needs to look for those opportunities to tell their story, whether it's at a public event where you can be the speaker and talk about something you're passionate about, because every time you're passionate about something, it comes through. And, you know, as architects, we are inherently loved by the community. I mean, generally not by developers, but by the general public. We're generally, you know, I don't know an architect that hasn't said to someone, what do you do for a profession? And if you say, I'm an architect, they don't say, oh, there's always this moment. That's amazing. You know?
Yeah. Very well respected.
Very well respected. And so I don't know why we don't capitalize on that. Because then if you ask them the question, like, do you know what I do? Then they come up blank. They don't know what we do.
Right.
But we're so respected. I mean, who else gets that kind of glory, right? Without doing anything. I don't know. we're in a great position. But once you do invest yourself in trying to find opportunities and say a journalist calls you, I think the best advice I can give you is call them back. Immediately, right? Don't forget to call them back and don't wait. If they need something, you drop what you're doing and you get it because
they're on a deadline
and they need their answer. And so you can't wait a week to give them an answer because they'll go find somebody else that will. And I suppose that's one thing is that I've always known that secret. And so they do come to me because they know they'll get an answer right away. And so I do make them a priority in my life because it doesn't take long.
Yeah.
You know, but I think making that a priority in your business to go out and find somewhere to tell your story is very important. Even if it's telling your family, you know, what you do at the dinner table, don't be afraid to tell them, let them know what you're doing.
That's great advice. And one of the things that I had done in the past, similar to what you just said, is that I actually looked at the articles that are being written in the home magazines and the newspapers and seeing who is writing them, and then reached out to them and said, hey, I'm an architect and I could be a resource for you. Here's my information. If you ever have any questions, I'm here for you. And I would get calls all the time. And then once you do it, like you said, once you do it once, then they know that you're a good resource and they'll come back, right? Because they know that you'll answer the question quickly. They'll give you the information. You'll give them the other resources that they need to look at. It saves them lots of time and gives them the information they need. And every time you do that, they write your name and their firm in the article.
That's right.
And so it's free publicity. It's a great strategy, and it's a great way to share your story.
I had a journalist friend once. I had her, asked her to do a seminar for me when I was president at AIA Florida. Yep. And so I asked her to do one of our seminars at convention, and she titled it, "Why Don't You Ever Call Me?"
Great.
And she said, architects never call me. Like, I'm always looking for a story. She was a freelance writer. And, you know, mostly she wrote about travel, but she always wanted to write about architecture. And so it's like, why don't we call them? Like you just said, right? Like, that's our opportunity. You know, they're out there. I mean, on the internet today, you know, content is king, right? And so those poor people that are writing, they got to have content. So they would like your story. So
That's great advice. And imagine what we could do if thousands of architects took your advice and they went out and just did one thing, right? Yes. If they listened to this episode and they went out and they did one thing, and 10,000 architects this week went out and shared their story. Imagine the impact that would have on our profession. Just that one step. Right.
Right.
And so don't think that your little story doesn't make a difference, because it's cumulative. It's cumulative for you, but it's also cumulative for the profession. The more we all do this, the more the story is written and the more the story is told. And our profession, the value of what we do as architects, is communicated. And it's then that story starts being told by the public. It's like, here's what I know. This is what architects do. And then over time, that will change, right? That's a very common complaint that architects have, is that the public doesn't know what we do. They don't know the value of an architect. Well, that's because you're not telling your story.
Exactly. So
it's not the AIA's job. It's not any professional organization's job. It's your job. You have to tell your story. And so, Joyce, I appreciate you for telling your story, sharing your story here at the Entre Architect Podcast. Thank you for your dedication to this profession. And helping this profession tell their stories through all these years, being a great role model and demonstrating how to do it. I appreciate you for coming by here today. If you want to learn more about Joyce, the company is Architecture Joyce Owens, or AJO. You can learn more at our website, architecturejoyceowens.com. Go there and say thank you. Joyce, thank you. Thank you for all you do. And I appreciate you for coming by here and sharing your knowledge at Entre Architect Podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. It's such a great opportunity and so much a part of like my mission, you know, to get this story out. So this is a dream come true to be here telling you my story today. So
thank you. I'm glad that you came. I'm glad that you're sharing your story. And if there's anything we can do, you just let us know and we'll get it out there. If you liked this episode of Entre Architect Podcast, please share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. I know I say this every episode, but I'd really love for you to send me some feedback. Share a rating, write a review, however you want to do that. And please share a link to this episode with a friend. Just send it off in an email. Say, hey, take a listen to this episode of Entre Architect Podcast, because that is how Entre Architect has grown to serve thousands more architects just like you. I appreciate it. Share a rating, write a review, and share a link to this episode with a friend. Thank you to all our sponsors for this episode. Links to all our sponsors and all the resources that we discussed today in this episode are available at the show notes for this episode, and all the episodes can be found at entrearchitect.com/podcast. EntreArchitect.com/podcast. Entre Architect is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. That's the media network that's dedicated to architects, engineers, and construction pros. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at GableMedia.com That's gablmedia.com. If you like this podcast, if you like Entree Architect podcast, I think you'll love all the podcasts at Gable Media. Go check them out at gablemedia.com. My name is Mark R. LePage. Thank you for listening to this episode of Entree Architect podcast. I appreciate you. Love, learn, and share what you know.
From historic homes to modern architecture, brick is one of the most popular building materials around the world.
How to allow the house to bridge the gap between the history of the site, the approachability of this kind of architecture in this kind of neighborhood, and the sort of nostalgia of materiality for the client's past, right? And brick really started to provide an answer for that.
Hi, I'm Doug Pat, and this is Design Vault. There aren't many materials that easily blend with any style and context, but brick does just that. I've seen some extraordinary work with brick, so when Glengarry approached me about hosting this podcast, I couldn't say no.
Typically, Tudor-style houses from outside are just stunningly gorgeous piece of structure, and when you go in, it's just sad.
Yeah.
Dark. And that is not going to happen with my approach to design.
I speak with industry leaders and share inspiring stories behind their work and ingenious design.
You'll see brick that's fashioned into basket weave patterns, sawtooth patterns, what's known in England as diapering.
Doesn't sound like you knew them per se, right? They found you through relationships that you had with other.
Well, wait, Doug, there's more.
Okay.
We'll go behind the scenes to understand process and even the inspiration that sparked the design.
You know, I think we were inspired by all the factory buildings in Dumbo. I mean, that is the kind of period of significance, that early American factory building.
Design Vault by Glengarry. Visit glengarry.com/design-vault or search for Design Vault wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe now to stretch your imagination.
Attention architects and creative minds, get ready to supercharge your brand with Build Your Brand, the podcast that's unlocking the secrets of branding success for creatives. Hey there, it's Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, and I'm inviting you to join my friend, architect marketing expert, Jeff Eccles at Build Your Brand podcast, where he explores the captivating stories of the world's top brands and transforms their lessons into powerful moves for small firm architects and creatives like you. In season one, Jeff shares the thrilling tale of Southwest Airlines, where he dissects their journey to the summit and distills it into strategies tailor-made for you.
It's important to keep in mind that companies like Southwest compete in the real world, just like you, and face real-world challenges, just like you. You might be surprised at how similar those challenges are to the struggles that you grapple with on a day-to-day basis.
Don't miss out on your blueprint for success. Subscribe, tune in, and let's build your brand together.
You may have noticed that the very best brands in the world are also known for having somewhat unique corporate cultures. That's often the glue that holds everything together when they encounter those rough spots.
We don't do it because it inconveniences the passengers to whom we are primarily dedicated, the short-haul frequent flyer.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Build Your Brand today. Remember, no matter the size, the journey's the same. Your brand's journey to the top starts here.